Welcome to All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. And today I join you as the new host of All Sides. I've been with WOSU Public Media for 17 years, and I've worked in public radio and journalism for more than two decades. I am humbled and excited to begin this new chapter of my career. Thank you to WOSU for putting your faith in me and placing me at the helm of this important news program. I promise to fulfill our mission to engage, inform, and inspire. And to the All Sides listeners, thank you so much for joining me. I also want to say thank you to Anna Staver for her work on the show, and we at WOSU wish her all the best as she begins her new job with Cleveland.com. And now, on to the task at hand. It's Monday and time for the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of the past week and preview the week ahead. And joining us is Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome, Jake.
Thank you for having me. Happy New Year and congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And also with us is Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Megan.
Glad to be here.
And also, do we have Haley B. Miller with us? She's a state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Haley, are you with us?
Yes, we do. Happy Monday.
Hi, thanks for being here, Haley. So today is the first day of the 136th General Assembly, but there's also a level two snow emergency here in Franklin County, which is why you're all joining me on Zoom instead of here in the studio with me. Are lawmakers still meeting today, Megan?
Yes, they are. Some of my colleagues I know are down there right now and will be in the House and the Senate. Haley or Jake, will you be there later this afternoon?
I will not be. Jesse is holding down the fort for us. But yeah, they decided that snow wasn't going to stop them from kicking things off and getting what they need to do done.
Are they like the U.S. Postal Service? No rain, nor snow, nor sleet, nor hail will stop the 136th General Assembly.
You know, I think if you're Matt Huffman and you have put a lot of work into this maneuver to go from Senate President to House Speaker, you are not going to let some inclement weather in the way of your big day.
All right. Hopefully everyone traveled. Maybe people traveled last night to be here. I don't know if people were traveling this morning, but can they convene if everyone can't make it?
Ooh, they need a quorum. I don't know what the quorum number is, but
I'm sure they have it figured out.
I bet they make a quorum. I don't imagine this one fumbling through the cracks.
All right.
I'm sure they planned ahead on this one with travel arrangements.
Yes, yes. Well, everyone seemed to know that the storm was coming. So, okay. Well, we will talk more about the General Assembly and what they have planned a little bit later in the hour. But I wanted to start with Lieutenant Governor John Husted. He has emerged as the front runner to replace J.D. Vance in the Senate. And the word is that the job is his if he wants it. Haley, is this a surprise for the Senate pick to be Husted?
So I don't like yes and no. At the very beginning of this, I felt that Husted was pretty determined to stay on the governor track. This is something that he's been working toward for a while. He's, you know, been raising money for the job and has always, I think, been interested in that position. But increasingly, it looks like there are some concerns about how messy this 2026 primary for governor could be. Attorney General Dave Yost is running, and I think another big impact is that we might see Vivek Ramaswamy running for governor in 2026. He's obviously part of the Trump administration, a close Trump ally, and so I think the thought is that he could pretty easily win a primary in Ohio if he got Trump support. So, you know, that leaves DeWine and Husted with, you know, a choice as to, okay, do we, you know, give the lieutenant governor a promotion now when we're in control of it, or do you roll the dice with the governor's race?
Yeah, Megan, what do you think about Husted not being governor? I mean, it's just for years we've all just thought, obviously, John Husted is the next governor of Ohio.
Right. He is a state guy. That's his background, is Ohio politics, with being Speaker of the House. I believe he was Secretary of State out as well. So it is kind of like a natural assumption that he would be running for governor. So it would be a transition definitely from him going from Ohio politics to the national scope of politics in D.C.
And Jake, Governor DeWine and Husted recently visited Mar-a-Lago, the residence of President-elect Donald Trump. And there was a lot of speculation. I mean, that's where this him being the front runner came from, the fact that the two of them went to visit Trump. DeWine has not always been the biggest fan of Trump and vice versa. So what do you think about this this meeting down there?
Yeah, I mean, I tune out a lot of the speculation about who might get what job, but it was with this Mar-a-Lago visit that I started to think that maybe this is more than just idle chatter. I mean, that seems to be where all the action happens, is over a trip to Mar-a-Lago. I think that Mike DeWine, one could read the tea leaves and say he doesn't get along with Donald Trump. And from time to time, Mike DeWine will say, I disagree with that in this very black and white way. But he spends a lot of time and political energy actually avoiding that. He seems to really think pragmatically. Like, again, I think if you just take a reasonable look at this and that policy difference, you could, and or especially this and that character difference, you could see a lot of contrast between the two. But I think Mike DeWine is more pragmatic than to just start throwing bombs. And that's why when a situation like this, you know, pops up, Mike DeWine can make these kinds of trips to Mar-a-Lago and really have Donald Trump's ear, despite the sometimes fraught relationship between them.
Mm-hmm. And Haley, do governors need to get the incoming president-elect's, you know, help with a Senate candidate?
I mean, I think DeWine is a very good politician, and he has repeatedly says that whoever he appoints needs to be able to win a primary in 2026. He wants this appointee to have a clear path to the November 2026 general election. And he knows for that to happen that, you know, Trump needs to like this appointee or at least be okay with it. He also has a close relationship with Vice President-elect J.D. Vance. So while they may not be, you know, while DeWine and Trump may not be the best of friends, I think DeWine is reading the room here and understands, you know, what it means for a Republican to be running for office in 2026. And it would be really hard to do that without Trump support.
Now, the official announcement is expected any day, any minute, any second now. I mean, DeWine could announce this at any time. If he's going to surprise us now and not pick Husted, who's it going to be, Megan?
Oh, that's a great question. This is really a long list of Republicans who names are floating around. Dave Yost is not on that list since he has thrown his effort into running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
But Frank Rose's name has been tossed around. Ohio Secretary of State Matt Dolan, who previously ran for the Senate before losing in the primary, as well as some Republican committee members as well here in Ohio.
And Haley, you mentioned, or I think it was you who mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy being a factor in this. I mean, talk about a guy who was nowhere and then everywhere. So what are your thoughts on him running for governor eventually, if that happens?
It's really interesting because I think, you know, being a former presidential candidate, he certainly positioned himself as most interested in working at the federal level. He will be part of the Trump administration leading this Department of Government Efficiency with Elon Musk. But that group's work is supposed to wrap up by 2026, so he can certainly start running for governor near the end of that. You know, it remains to be seen, I think, whether he really, really wants to be governor or he maybe just sees it as a springboard to something else. But talking to reporters back in November, the day after the election in Columbus, you know, he said he's viewed himself as more of an executive, not necessarily a legislator. So that signaled, you know, to me and I think others that he wasn't super interested in the Senate seat, which was a question back then.
Yeah, I guess Trump putting him in the Senate seat is not happening. So, well, DeWine would put him in, I guess, if Trump says so. All right. So I guess we just wait and see when Governor DeWine decides to make that announcement. Another thing that we are waiting on with Governor DeWine is the so-called parental rights bill. Governor Mike DeWine said he is likely to sign it. He has 10 days from the time when it reached his desk. So Jake, where are we with the deadline?
Yeah, well, by my count, there were that bill passed 7 days ago. Governor DeWine has 10 days to sign it, or he can just not sign it and let it passively become law. So he's got a few days. I never know, and I swear it seems to change every other year whether or not we count Sundays or how we process holidays here. So I don't want to give too hard and fast of a deadline.
Megan, are you shaking your head because you don't know the date either, or when he has to sign it?
I wish I knew the deadline as well, but no, I agree with Jake that it could come probably any day now, hopefully, or not hopefully, but I'm assuming it'll be this week.
Hopefully from a reporter's perspective where you're like, I wrote this story. If he's going to veto it, tell me, please. Right. So, I mean, basically, it seems like Governor DeWine is going to sign this parental rights bill. Lawmakers made some changes to it at the governor's request. Megan, what changes did DeWine want to see? Can you give us a little refresher on the law?
Yeah, so this bill started off, as you were saying, the parental bill of rights that would just basically limit and restrict the sexuality content in classrooms in K through 12. Classroom settings and give parents the option ahead of time to have their children opt out of these instructional materials and have alternatives be provided. The bill went through many, many changes, including banning sexuality content in grades K through three. And then in the days leading up to the final lame duck session, they added another controversial bill, the religious release time bill, that would just mandate Ohio school districts to have a policy in place, just changing the law from shall have a policy to or may to shall, so requiring districts to have a policy, whereas before it was up to the school district to decide.
So they're saying the school district has to have a policy, but the school district could still say their policy is no early release, right?
That is correct. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of like a loophole, so to speak, in the policy. I know that former Speaker of the House, Jason Stevens, had asked that they have background checks for the volunteers or people who work in the religious release time programs. Lifewise Academy is the big one here in Ohio. They're actually based in Hilliard, so Central Ohio connection. And so that was a concern that was raised a lot during testimony. And so that was an addition that was added to the bill in like the last minute of having background checks be a mandated part of this bill.
And the bill was controversial. It has some controversial parts to it, drawing support from Christian groups such as the Center for Christian Virtue. Here's Mike Andrews, the group's communications director. He's telling Spectrum News why he is in favor of the Parental Bill of Rights.
We're excited for parents throughout the state of Ohio to be able to control their child's upbringing when it comes to their educational choices and healthcare decisions that they make. That's the purpose of the bill and why we were proud to support it.
But opponents like Charles Ferguson, a senior pastor at Clare United Methodist Church here in Columbus, had this to say.
I come from a denomination that says do no harm, and we should do no harm. But this is straight up doing harm on purpose.
Megan, how have members of the LGBTQ community reacted to this legislation?
Yeah, it was not really a surprise that this bill passed, and there have been several anti-LGBTQ bills that have passed in the General Assembly, and so just a lot of disappointment and feeling really discouraged, but not really surprised when it comes to members of the LGBTQ with this bill passing.
And State Senator Louis Blessing, he was the only Republican in the Senate to vote against it. Either Jake or Haley, did he oppose it? Did he think it went too far? I can't remember exactly what he said.
I couldn't speak to the specific bill, but he has increasingly seemed to find himself standing in corner A while most of the Senate Republican caucus is in corner B. So that's just part and parcel for a pattern that's been coming out with the senator from Cincinnati.
Haley, you have anything else to add about the Parental Bill of Rights, such as when he will sign it?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone is right. It's going to be sometime this week. You know, what day? Who is anyone's guess? But It does seem on track to pass despite, a lot of opposition to it. And, regarding Blessing, I think, he did think it went too far. He said he's Catholic, but it just didn't do the trick for him.
Another thing that happened in this past General Assembly dealt with hospital transparency. Ohio hospitals will soon be asked to disclose the cost of medical care that they provide to consumers. Haley, this applies to those with and without insurance. So, what exactly will change in terms of what consumers will be told now versus before?
Yeah, so this is in line with a federal rule that's been in place for a little while now. Hospitals have to post a list of costs for their standard services. And then from there, they can either publish the costs or provide price estimates for shoppable services. Those are the things that you schedule in advance, like surgery and whatnot, the things that you have time to kind of price shop for versus, an emergency situation. And Republicans who supported this legislation, I mean, this was a pretty big fight because the House posted passed, excuse me, a much stronger bill in terms of price transparency. For example, hospitals would have had to publish the cost of the exact cost of shoppable services as well. They didn't really want to see these price estimator tools. The Senate essentially gutted that bill. And so what passed at the end of last GA was a compromise, which, I talked to one of the House sponsors, Rep. Ron Ferguson, about it. And he said he was still really happy with the final product. And he felt that this goes further than the federal rule because it requires the state to penalize hospitals who don't comply, whereas the feds, it's kind of the enforcement mechanisms aren't quite as strong. So Ferguson still sees Ohio as a leader in this space.
Jake, what if the hospitals don't comply with this? I know that, I mean, Haley just mentioned a kind of a workaround, but what if they don't?
I don't know the specific enforcement mechanisms, but I think Haley got it in that there are enforcement mechanisms. The compliance rate with a federal rule is pretty paltry. It's somewhere like one of five hospitals actually disclose their services. And for those that do, if you ever look it up, it's Byzantine. I mean, it is absolutely a labyrinth to make sense of what service you need and what it actually will cost you.
And this bill covers 300 shoppable services. I mean, when you think of medical care, that doesn't seem like very much, right?
And I think, one thing I've wondered about all these rules, the idea here is that if you have price transparency, you have a clear market and consumers can shop around and find the best price. But this stuff is so technical. I mean, how many people really understand what healthcare services they need and are procuring? And I guess I'm curious to see if this is really a benefit to consumer, if people will realistically shop around for services or if this is just a page on a website that idles.
Megan, would you want to add something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm kind of like Jake was saying, I'm just curious how many people will use it or even be aware of it aside from folks like us who follow this kind of stuff. So yeah, curious as how it'll be promoted, if it will be at all, by just for different hospital networks.
Did the bill have any marketing written into it? Any money for marketing, right? To tell people about it? I can't imagine hospitals will be like, oh, by the way, you here, look up this, you should look at this, right? That doesn't seem like a logical thing for hospitals to do to show people.
Yeah, there are rules in there about how they need to display this information, and it's basically a computer readable format, which can actually get, computer readable formats are can actually be pretty technical and kind of garbled, but the bill I do believe says that, there needs to be like summaries of the services included that are hopefully understandable to the average human, but otherwise no major requirements on as to, how this is displayed. So I suppose a hospital could, bury this on their website if they wanted to.
All right. Well, coming up, the latest on a correctional officer who was killed by an inmate on Christmas Day. You're listening to the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides, and we'll be back in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics, and I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us is Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Last Friday, more than 200 correctional officers and 1,000 mourners were there to remember Ross Correctional Officer Andrew Lansing. News broke on Christmas Day that an inmate at Ross Correctional Institution killed Lansing. What more do we know about the deadly attack and who was responsible, Megan?
Yes, so it was an inmate of the prison who's, apologies, and his name escapes me at this moment, but I know that they, from my understanding from...
Rashawn Cannon.
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. They previously had some interactions that have been documented and just some other incidents that took place leading up to this that were documented. And I saw that there's going to be a protest, I believe, outside the prison, I believe, later this week in response to this and to other just violence within prisons as well.
And Jake, the State Prison Guards Union is asking Governor DeWine to suspend the prison director and the warden pending an investigation into the death. What has the governor's response been? Has he said anything?
I'm afraid I'm really not the person to ask on this one.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, Haley, do you know if the governor's talked about this?
Yeah. I'm not clear if, you know, he's been persuaded by the request to suspend the guard, but, you know, this has been a really messy situation, you know, since the death on Christmas. There have been allegations that prison guards are now retaliating against people who are incarcerated. They're turning off their body cameras and, you know, only serving them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, not allowing them to shower. The Ohio Department of Corrections has said that's absolutely not true, but, you know, just a lot of tensions, I think, in that facility right now. And, you know, it remains to be clear what more the state is going to do to address kind of the fallout from this.
It's the first time in 28 years a corrections officer was killed. In 1996, a social worker named Bonita Haynes was murdered. She was working alone in the Lima Correctional Institution. And I'm not sure if any procedures or changes were implemented following her death back in 1996. I think, does that predate all of us working in the news?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if this was a direct response, but, you know, I know that generally now, you know, prison guards have to have body cams and that kind of thing. I'm not sure if that was a direct response to that incident or mm-hmm. not.
And Megan, you're right. A Chillicothe newspaper reported that a protest is planned for January 10th. It's being organized by prison reform advocates. So maybe we'll get some updates on the situation there after that. Okay, so Jake, you wrote recently that there are plans in the works to overhaul the state's energy policy. It's something that the new House Speaker, Matt Huffman, is working on. And what shape is it expected to take?
That's correct. I mean, no one really knows the answer to that question. There's rumors of some big energy bill have been going around in Capitol Square. Senate President Matt Huffman, when he was asked about it, he gave cryptic comments. He said whatever it is going to be ambitious. He framed it as changing a way of thinking where whatever we do with energy policy typically involves money from ratepayers going to utility companies. He didn't specify beyond that. I've heard all kinds of different ideas of what the bill might be. Different policies that have been kicked around. And I want to stress that I would take all these with a grain of salt. These are people who seem to be one person away from being in the room. But getting rid of electric security plans, which are, instead of these comprehensive rate reviews, just letting utilities ask for a couple $100 million for this specific project or that specific project instead of a comprehensive look at the books. Letting these data centers, which are very, very energy intensive operations, run gas plants behind the meter. So basically private gas plants for a data center. The interesting thing about the bill is that there were two I would call them clean energy bills that were pretty late stage in the process in the legislative session last year, up for a vote. There was one that would, to spare some details, allow the creation of new solar farms on blighted properties, and another that would allow utilities to run energy efficiency programs, which would just reduce Ohio overall's net energy consumption. Both those bills had votes pulled on them very abruptly without explanation late in the legislative session. And backers of those bills are pointing at whatever this mysterious energy bill is saying. Apparently, we want to preserve, someone is trying to preserve the status quo to lay groundwork for this energy bill. Said Rob McCauley, one of the supposed negotiators of this bill, declined to comment. So it's mysterious, but Matt Huffman has at least openly acknowledged that something ambitious is in the works here.
Is Matt Huffman known as an energy guy? Is this unusual for him, or is this something that he has been working on behind the scenes?
I think Matt Huffman has a lot of thumbs and a lot of pies. Yeah, I wouldn't just peg him strictly as an energy guy. I think what's just one interesting dynamic is Ohio's last energy bill turned out to be the product of a criminal conspiracy. There have been like 7, 8 indictments filed.
Oh, are you talking about the old House Bill 6?
The old House Bill 6. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but seriously, the last legislative champion of a major energy bill in Ohio is in prison in connection with that energy bill. So that is the context in which we're operating here. And mm-hmm. I think that is lost on no one in the state house.
Right. And do you think it's being driven? You mentioned all those data centers opening. I mean, they have massive energy demands, and we are becoming, I mean, it's like every other day they're announcing a new thing is being built or delayed or all of that. Is that really what's behind it?
I think that's a major part behind it, is these data centers are really dramatically increasing Ohio's electricity demand. And because that demand is going up, we need to build this very expensive infrastructure, and someone's got to pay for it to distribute all this energy. And then meanwhile, we have a lot of major coal plants in Ohio that are retiring mm-hmm. because it's just not economic anymore. And we've made it pretty hard to develop solar, especially wind, but in part solar in Ohio. So we're struggling to build new renewable energy. Coal is retiring, but these coal plants are huge and produce a lot of power, and our demand is going up. PJM, we exist on a 13-state regional grid. PJM just they sell power in the future, in the out years. They just hit historic, like astronomical prices that they haven't hit customers' bills yet, but they will. So I think that these things are all playing out together. None of this exists on an island. And yeah, we're looking at huge, huge demand increases and supply decreases. And any economist could tell you what happens next.
That phrase, they sell power in the future, that just, it sounds like it belongs in a movie or something. I don't even know how to wrap my head around that. How do you sell power in the future? Megan or Haley, do you have any, are you into this energy bill that Huffman is backing, or do you have anything you want to add?
No, I think Jake covered. Yeah.
All right. Jake's our energy expert. So while we're on the topic, though, you've written about fracking too, Jake. So near Salt Fork State Park, that's been a center of a lot of fracking, and there was a well pad that caught on fire very recently. And there's a group that is continuously trying to, you know, pull back on or stop the fracking at Salt Fork State Park, among others. So this is a part of Ohio's energy future too, as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of the more interesting things going on in the gas sector. And yeah, all over, I mean, that's already a very, very gaseous part of Ohio. There's an incredible amount of production over there. And
I like that. Yeah, I'm going to lean onto that phrase, a gaseous part of Ohio. Okay.
I recommend never saying that. I can't believe I said it today. But
no, I Salt Fork State Park is one of my favorite state parks, and now I will always think of it as gaseous. Okay. Go ahead.
But I think the fire that was, you know, that went around because the fire chief caught footage of it. But I don't think that that's as rare of an incident as the industry tends to make it out to be. I think just last year there was a well blowout, or if not the year before, in the area. So this is, you know, I mean, where you're talking about shooting very, very high pressures of water, sand, and chemicals underground, and then pumping all that back up to the surface. These are very industrial, high pressure operations, and accidents happen. These are flammable materials, and these are all now happening in conserved spaces, sensitive spaces, and we're going to watch this thing play out one way or another.
if a well catches on fire and nobody's there to take a video of it, then did it actually happen? Is that basically what it is?
It did.
Yes.
Make no mistake, it
yes.
did.
All right. Well, let's just take a few minutes before we end here to talk about the 136th General Assembly. I mean, it convenes today. And is there anything you can tell us, Haley, about the makeup of the new body? Anything we need to know that's different from the 135th Assembly?
Still very Republican. You know, Republicans still have a supermajority in the legislature. And what I think is going to be different about this GA compared to the last GA is that the House Speaker Matt Huffman and Senate President Rob McCauley are going to be much more unified than Huffman and Stevens were. So I think you can expect to see some conservative priorities making their way through the legislature the next couple of years. You know, McCauley and Huffman obviously worked together for several years in the Senate, and there's not a whole lot of daylight between the two of them. So I don't think you're going to see the same level of Republican turmoil that we have that, you know, led the last session to be very unproductive in terms of bills passed and that kind of thing.
Megan, is there leftover legislation from last term that you're keeping an eye on that you think will come up soon?
Yes, with Huffman becoming or being speaker-elect, I expect there to be more marijuana legislation as far as reforms with the legalization of recreational marijuana in Ohio. I also think we'll be seeing a comeback of the Senator Jerry Serino's higher ed bill, which was Senate Bill 83. You know, to be determined what number it'll be given when he reintroduces it this year. But he has made it very clear that he will reintroduce this bill that would drastically change higher ed.
What will it do to higher ed? What was his plan originally?
Yeah, the bill went through lots of changes, but there would be an anti-striking provision that ended up being removed from the bill. But he has said that that is a possibility of being back on the table. It would also it would change the relationships that colleges have with Chinese colleges and institutions. It would also, there was a retrenchment policy as far as faculty being able to faculty and tenure faculty with their contracts. So lots of potential changes, as well as a controversial topics that, you know, may or may not be discussed in class and lectures. But he basically said, Senator Serino told me that there's more that he could add to the bill. So we'll see what happens.
And besides the energy bill that we just discussed, Jake, is there anything else that you're keeping an eye on?
You know, I'm actually watching the politics. I think what's interesting is the Democrats actually picked up seats in the House, but the previous House Speaker relied on a coalition that included the House Democrats. So it's counterintuitive that the Democrats gained seats, but in all likelihood lost political power. So A, I'm wondering if that theory holds, and B, what that looks like.
And Haley, just in the minute we have left, what other, is there a bill in particular that you are looking at?
Marijuana is another thing that's definitely on my radar. Megan kind of gave us a lay of the land on that. I'm also curious to see if the legislature makes any election changes. We saw some legislation introduced late in the process that, you know, didn't get anywhere last GA, but could come back again. You know, there are some things that Secretary of State Frank LaRose has pushed the legislature to do. So I don't think we've seen the last on the election reform front.
Okay. Well, I want to say thank you to our reporters for our politics roundtable today. We're going to pivot to national news on this anniversary of January 6th. But I want to say thank you to Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for being here, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you, Haley, for being here.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a Washington Post journalist on today's fourth anniversary of the storming of the U.S. Capitol. That's when All Sides continues. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Today marks the fourth anniversary of January 6th, when a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol to try to overturn Joe Biden being certified as the 46th president. 5 people died in the attack or in the immediate aftermath, and 140 police officers were assaulted. More than 1,000 were convicted, with many jailed. And President-elect Donald Trump has spoken of pardoning them for their crimes. Joining us now is Washington Post national columnist Philip Bump. Welcome to All Sides, Philip.
Thank you very much.
So in reviewing Washington Post's coverage from that day 4 years ago, it made me remember watching all the events unfold live on TV and what an unbelievable sight it was. Does it still feel raw to you, even though it's been 4 years?
Yeah, very much. I mean, obviously not as raw as in the moment, but you know, one of the things I think, and I'm writing about this for the Post today, but I think that we have since that day only gotten a better appreciation for the scale of what unfolded. I mean, a lot of the violence that actually occurred wasn't seen in real time. You know, we didn't see, for example, the videos of protesters, you know, crushing a police officer between doors in a hallway in the Capitol. Like, you know, images like that fleshed out what was actually occurring in a way that I think makes it more emotionally potent, even though it's not happening now, but simply because we have a better sense of what actually unfolded.
I heard a story this morning on NPR's Morning Edition where they were talking about it and saying that tour guides who give tours of the Capitol are told not to talk about it. They don't talk about that. They talk about the art and the architecture and the history of the Capitol, but they do not talk about January 6th. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a strikingly polarized issue, right? I mean, this is, you know, while in the moment, I think every objective observer saw what was happening and was absolutely stunned and shocked by it. But over the course of the past 4 years, there's been a very systematic effort to try and recast it as being something other than what it actually was. And as such, because there has been this effort, there is a steeply polarized perception of what occurred. On the right, the Capitol riot is seen as a relatively benign incident that has been blown out of proportion by the left as part of an effort to impugn Donald Trump. By the left and the middle and objective observers, it is something very different. But because of that, you know, this is another example, I think, where partisanship has made it safer to say nothing than to say the truth.
Yeah, that surprised me. I mean, I have to imagine if someone is on a tour of the Capitol and they ask about it, the tour guides are... they probably talk about it, but that story made me feel like they have to pivot. They have to pivot and say, or let me tell you about when this caught on fire in 18, whatever, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I also think that what happened at the Capitol was so widespread that it's not as though there was there wasn't really an overlap between an interesting place in the Capitol and a memorable event, right? Like, you're not going to show, as part of a tour of the Capitol, you're not going to go down that hallway where that police officer was crushed between the door. Like, that's not part of the tour. It's just not, you know, because this was occurring at different places in the Capitol. And so, you know, I think that probably the you know, beyond actually getting to the floor of the House or the Senate, there probably aren't a lot of things that people would recognize and say, oh, I remember seeing that on TV on January 6, 2021. Mm-hmm.
Federal prosecutors have secured over 1,100 convictions so far for more than 600 rioters. They've been sentenced to prison terms. Here's an exchange with NBC's Kristen Welker on whether President-elect Trump will pardon the January 6th rioters. Here's how a part of that conversation went.
But you're going to consider pardoning even those who've pleaded guilty to crimes, including assaulting police officers?
Well, sometimes they say, here's your choice.
You're not ruling it out.
Look, I know the system. The system's a very corrupt system. They say to a guy, you're going to go to jail for 2 years or for 30 years. And these guys are looking, their whole lives have been destroyed. For 2 years, they've been destroyed. But the system is a very nasty system.
Okay. Let's
move on. I'm going to look at everything. We're going to look at individual cases, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm going to be acting very quickly.
Within your first 100 days, first day?
First day.
Philip, can he pardon those who have been sentenced already, including those convicted of the most serious charges?
He can. All this occurred in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, it is not a state. It is part of the federal government. It is a place controlled by the federal government, and he has pardon authority. These are federal crimes, and he can pardon or commute the sentences of those who have been convicted. If you look, all of those you mentioned, more than 1,100 people had been convicted or, you know, reached plea deals for what they had done. All of them are through the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., and so he has that power. And you know, this is, I think, a particularly unusual aspect of this entire discussion.
Do you think that it was just Trump campaign speak, or do you think he's going to do it? I mean,
I think he absolutely will. I think the only question is the scale. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to do a blanket pardon for everyone. I mean, there's no upside to pardoning, for example, members of the, you know, extremist groups, the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, right? Like that's just not something that's going to bear any political reward. But he will pardon hundreds of people. I think it's safe to assume, simply because he recognizes that this reinforces his longstanding argument that the government is out to get the right, even though in this case, you know, what those pro-Trump actors did was pretty obvious and often caught on tape.
Now, President Biden still has a few more days in office, and it was also mentioned in that same NBC interview that President Biden could preemptively pardon former Republican Representative Liz Cheney. She was the co-chair of the investigative committee, the January 6th committee. Is that a likely scenario? Does Liz Cheney need a pardon from Biden?
It's an interesting question. I suspect that it probably won't happen, but I will admit that it's very likely I'll be wrong. But it seems unlikely, in part because one of the things that we saw during the first Trump administration and have seen from Republicans in Congress is that criminal charges are not necessarily even the desired end game. I mean, it sort of is this validation of the arguments that are being made. But if you look, for example, at Joe Biden's son, Hunter, who was issued a pardon by his father and who was the target of an extended effort by Republicans to try and tie his alleged nefarious activity, and in some cases fairly obvious alleged activity, mm-hmm. to his father, but it's ongoing. Even though that pardon has happened, we've seen Republican legislators say, we're still going to go after Hunter Biden, yada, yada, yada. The tools of the federal government, when brought to bear on a private citizen, extend well beyond what the Justice Department can do. And so I think that, you know, we can expect to see congressional investigations into the January 6th House Select Committee, as though there was something wrong there, simply because that is what many people on the right believe is the proper and just thing to do, even though it isn't.
Looking ahead to the inauguration, have you heard anything about Trump's inauguration on the 20th? Anything unique planned? Have they released any details?
No, I mean, there are certainly unique aspects to it. There's in particular the fundraising component, which I think is striking, and the amount of money that the inaugural committee has gotten, and some of the ways in which Trump and his allies are themselves trying to fundraise off of it, I think are unusual. But no, I haven't heard anything. One thing that I am tracking is he put this post on social media in recent days, which suggested that he found it. He objected to flags being at half staff in remembrance of former President Jimmy Carter. And I'll be very curious to see if his interest in the optics of having the flags at full staff are overweigh the sort of tradition of paying respect to former presidents. I think that'll sort of be an indicator of what a Trump presidency might look like in the microcosm if he just simply can't abide having this moment of respect for Jimmy Carter at his own personal moment of political triumph.
How long are the flags supposed to be at half staff for Carter?
I mean, well past January 20th. It was 30 days as of Carter's death, which was December 31st. Am I correct? I don't remember when. But so, yeah, I'd say they are still supposed to be at half staff through January 20th.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was 30 days. I was just assumed, yeah. As you started talking about that, I assumed that the flags would go to full staff after the funeral. But so it's supposed to be 30 days. So they. Yeah. So you're saying that the flags technically should be at half staff during the inauguration.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, again, this is something that can be done, you know, it's done by the president. So John Storm becomes president noon on January 20th, and it's possible 12:01, you see the flags raised over the Capitol and, you know, what he views as a symbolic gesture of his triumph.
Hmm. Well, I also know, I know the inauguration is always on January 20th, but this time it also happens to be Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And I was, you know, I guess Trump will be starting his term by having to pay all those Capitol Police officers time and a half for working on a holiday, which seems to go against his government efficiency office, right? Have you heard any reaction to that?
No, I mean, you know, one of the things that is true of Donald Trump is that he does not pay close attention to details unless someone on Fox News brings them to his attention, being a little flip there. But, you know, so unless this becomes a huge issue in the right wing conservative media sphere, I don't think that he's going to worry about it too much.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, there's definitely been reaction to it being on Martin Luther King Day, but I guess that just is January 20th is when it has to be, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I wouldn't put it past Trump to try to move it, but that's not going to happen. So on Trump's inauguration, also at the Ohio native, JD Vance becomes the vice president. So, he's 40 and he's seen as the future of the MAGA movement. What will you be watching when you think of JD Vance? What are you looking for there?
Yeah. I mean, I think that J.D. Vance has, to some extent, flown under the radar to the national audience. I mean, obviously, people became more familiar with him as the campaign unfolded. He is in an interesting position, too, because we shouldn't overlook the fact that Donald Trump is, you know, he will, should he serve his entire term, end up being the oldest president that's ever served, you know, even older than Joe Biden by the end of his term in office. And, you know, that in the same way that that meant, you know, a significant for Kamala Harris. She was serving under a very old president, so will J.D. Vance be. And so I think that makes him a more interesting person simply by virtue of the fact that he has an increased likelihood of potentially becoming president, even, you know, outside of the context of the election. You know, I don't know if he is the banner carrier for the MAGA movement should Donald Trump, you know, once Donald Trump is actually out of the political picture. I think Donald Trump Jr. may be a more natural person to point to, and I think has more of a grasp on the right wing discussion and conversational bubble, and that's where the power on the right exists. You know, J.D. Vance was able to be elected senator. He sort of ran alongside Blake Masters in Arizona, who was not able to become senator. I'm not sure that J.D. Vance, I think, leveraged Donald Trump's popularity successfully in order to first be elected and then to become vice president, but I don't think he has the grasp on it that others do. And so, you know, while I think he's certainly well positioned to be president or run for president in 2028, I'm not sure that he is the natural inheritor of the Trump movement, or honestly, if there even would be an inheritor of the Trump movement.
Yeah, I was wondering if you saw J.D. Vance moving more toward the middle, like if Trump's going to make him be the poster boy for trying to like, oh, yeah, we're trying to be inclusive. Look at what Vance is doing over there.
Yeah, well, I mean, except that we have two predicates, right? And the first is the first Trump presidency, and the second is the actual campaign in which Vance was the VP pick. And in neither case was there a significant effort by Trump or his vice president or vice presidential candidate to try and reach across the aisle, right? You know, J.D. Vance was not a moderating influence. Often, vice presidential candidates are attack dogs on the campaign trail, and J.D. Vance was very much that. But, you know, Mike Pence was not a guy who, from 2017 to 2021, was out there trying to get Democrats on board with the MAGA agenda, in part because no one speaks for Trump besides Trump. And there is, you know, the Trump administration is not an administration. It is Trump and a bunch of people who work for Trump. And as such, you know, it's hard to be someone who is asked to do stuff on behalf of Trump because, you know, Trump can turn around and undermine it the next minute in a tweet. So, you know, I think that's probably not going to happen.
Well, we have 30 seconds left. What do you have? One prediction of something that Trump made a long list of what he's going to do in his first day. Which one will he actually do?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we forget about 2017 is when he came into office, he tried to do a lot of stuff very quickly, not necessarily in the first day. I think we're going to see that again. I think pardons for January 6th are likely because those are easy and easy to prepare in advance. And I think we can expect a lot of executive orders on immigration, things along those lines that end up not necessarily going into effect, but end up in protracted legal battles, which is what we saw 4 years ago.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That is Washington Post national columnist Philip Bump. Thanks for joining us for All Sides today.
You bet.
And thank you for listening to All Sides and our weekly reporter roundtable. We covered state politics and national politics. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News.